Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a hearing today before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Russian Interference in Our Election, at which former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates and former Director of National Intelligence General Clapper testified. Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and as a special advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues and as a member of the Secretary's policy planning staff, joins us. We will discuss President Trump's attempt to intimidate the key witness, Sally Yates, and her testimony about efforts to warn an apparently unconcerned White House that the National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, could be blackmailed by the Russians. This following President Obama's personal warning to the president-elect in their first White House meeting that Trump should not hire Flynn as his national security advisor, a warning that fell on deaf ears. Then we'll speak with Yuri Friedman, a staff writer at The Atlantic who covers global affairs and was previously the deputy managing editor at Foreign Policy. He joins us to discuss his latest article in The Atlantic, Is France's Political Crisis Just Beginning?, and how the hacking of the French election was brought up in the hearing today in the context of what the US, France, and Germany can do to prevent further Russian interference in their elections. We will assess what leverage the Europeans have given their dependence on Russian energy and what measures the US might take. Then finally, we'll look into the firing of five scientists on the EPA's Board of Scientific Counselors, with the likely purge of up to a dozen on the 18-member board, who are to be replaced by representatives from polluting industries because, according to the EPA spokesman, Scott Pruitt, the administrator, quote, believes we should have people on this board who understand the impact of regulations on the regulated community. Joining us is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University, who shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and is the author of The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. We will discuss a Stalinist takeover of the government by climate deniers who are imposing fake science on a dangerously real problem. And joining us now is Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and was special advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues and also served as a member of the Secretary's policy planning staff, where he worked on cybersecurity and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Fuchs.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here.
And thank you for joining us. And the hearings today with Sally Yates and General Clapper testifying before the Judiciary Subcommittee chaired by Lindsey Graham and co-chaired by Sheldon Whitehouse has largely been about General Flynn. And, of course, Sally Yates played an important role. But as with some of the earlier hearings, some of the best questions seem to come from Senator Al Franken, where he was trying to get Sally Yates to explain why it was that the White House counsel seemed lackadaisical about the important information that she was giving him a heads up on, that this guy was compromised by the Russians. And he was saying, you know, Obama warned Trump not to hire this guy, and yet they went ahead and hired him. And he was allowed to go on a phone call with Putin. And more importantly, we don't know exactly what heads up he gave the Russian ambassador. Just as Obama was about to impose sanctions on Putin for interfering in our elections. So could it be that Flynn actually told the Russians about who was going to be sanctioned and therefore gave them time to move their money?
Well, that's looking more and more like a real possibility here. You know, today's hearings, I think, have really driven home a few points for us watching this unfolding saga of Trump and his associates and their connections to Russia. First is what you alluded to, which was the then acting Attorney General Sally Yates trying to make the White House counsel aware of these compromising statements that General Flynn, the National Security Advisor Flynn, had made about his conversations with the Russian Ambassador Kislyak. And as you alluded to as well, The White House did not seem very concerned about this. That is a very strange reaction to have when the acting attorney general tries to warn you that the national security advisor could be susceptible to blackmail by Russia. That should be very, very concerning and set off massive alarm bells for the White House counsel. And so I think that what we are learning here is that, of course, these are some very serious concerns about Mike Flynn and his connections with Russia and what he was doing. Was he giving them a heads up about the sanctions, about what Trump's approach would be? But it also raises some very serious questions, of course, about Trump himself and others in the campaign and the administration and what they knew about this. I mean, Trump to this day, including yesterday and today, has been out there defending Mike Flynn and trying to disparage his critics, including Sally Yates, which of course begs the question of why would Trump be doing that?
Well, but he's got his chorus of enablers there on the Republican side, Senator Grassley and Senator Cruz. All they're interested in is trying to score points about whether or not Susan Rice unmasks some people in this intelligence gathering process that sometimes involves, when they target foreign targets, sometimes U.S. persons get wrapped up in it. And that's a desperate attempt, just as Trump has a desperate attempt to try and get out from under those tweets where he called President Obama a bad and sick guy. They will go to any lengths to invent evidence that doesn't exist or try and gin some little shred of evidence up into some credible excuse for why Trump would make such an outrageous remark for which he refuses to apologize. Isn't that the dynamic that's going on here? And that leads you to the main question is, why are these Republicans defending the indefensible President of the United States?
Well, that is the big question, I think, for everybody. It seems to me that the politics are driving this for many of the Republicans and, of course, for the president, because they see smoke coming from this investigation into Trump and his connections with Russia, and whether the big question of whether or not there was any collusion between the two during the campaign last year. And they know that there's a lot of smoke, and so there very well may be some fire. And so they are doing everything that they can to obfuscate the president, from the president on down, right? The president himself is tweeting regularly about this, trying to shift blame elsewhere, trying to intimidate a witness, the former acting attorney general of the United States, Sally Yates, trying to intimidate her before testifying today, which is quite unprecedented. And you see, you know, Senator Cruz, as you mentioned, Chuck Grass, Senator Grassley, and others clearly trying to divert from the bigger questions around Trump's connections to Russia. And that, of course, is, I think, them just looking for a way out, because they realize that they've been supporting this guy in the Oval Office now. They've been supporting President Trump. They want, you know, to pass certain types of legislation elsewhere, and so they want people to forget about this issue. But the more that comes out, the more that people get concerned, and frankly, the more that they seem to obfuscate, the more that it seems to raise some serious questions about what they are trying to obfuscate.
So in terms of, you know, being the decent Republican who seems to be more patriotic than partisan, and that, of course, is both Lindsey Graham, the chair, and John McCain, his friend, who wrote an op-ed in Monday's New York Times castigating Tillerson for his foreign policy that is devoid of American values, going back to realpolitik, where a country acts according to its interests but not according to its ideals. And in the case of Tillerson being ExxonMobil, we don't know whether America's interests now are making an oil deal with Putin, do we?
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, you see, I think, Senators Graham and McCain and others, at least on some issues like the Trump-Russia connections, like where human rights stands within U.S. foreign policy, clearly trying to drive at the Trump administration and push them in the right direction. On the first point, I think that, you know, this hearing in and of itself obviously has a little bit of a history, because this was supposed to be a hearing that happened weeks ago, but of course the Trump administration successfully derailed it, and frankly derailed the investigation into Trump and Russia connections in the House Committee on Intelligence, with the antics by its chairman, Devin Nunes. And so eventually they had to get this hearing from the subcommittee on the Judiciary Committee, chaired by Lindsey Graham, who wants to push forward on this, to get Sally Yates to testify finally here, despite the Trump administration's best efforts. And so, frankly, these investigations will need, frankly, some level of bipartisan support to continue moving forward because of Republican control of both houses of Congress. But you also see, as you mentioned, some Republicans and also many Democrats as well trying to push this administration to change its foreign policy approach so far. And that includes a variety of things. That includes one, of course, trying to push back against some aggressive actions by Russia, not just in terms of hacking our election, but in terms of their threats against neighbors, NATO neighbors in Europe, which is still of grave concern, their interference in allies and allied elections. We saw just over the weekend a massive hack against the campaign of now President-elect Emmanuel Macron, where they dumped a whole bunch of information that was hacked from the Macron campaign, which may very well be traced back to Russia. We don't know yet. But so there are many who are trying to push the Trump administration in the right direction on foreign policy, human rights, of course, being one of those main issues where the administration, the Trump administration to date, has made very clear that they do not care about human rights and advancing human rights abroad. And you've seen that, whether it's with respect to inviting the strongman leader of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, to the White House, the dictator of Thailand, General Prayut, to the White House, and just frankly not talking about it or paying attention to it across the board.
So, Michael Fuchs, the Center for American Progress has a Russia project underway. Are you a part of it?
Yes, we all contribute to this project.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I was recently speaking with the co-founder of DC Reports, which is started by David K. Johnston, investigative journalist who knows Trump pretty well, has written about him, and looks like Trump dumped his 2005 tax returns in David's mailbox because they made Trump look good. He won't obviously release any more taxes, but his partner in that, Jim Henry, I was talking to him the other day. He's an investigative economist and done some really important work on offshore and pirate banking. He was telling me that he thinks that Trump is more vulnerable on the emolument side of it than he is on necessarily on what they're looking into in terms of Russian hacking and directed by Putin to help elect Trump, which is what the consensus of our intelligence communities have come to some time back. When you talk about reaching out to Duterte and congratulating Erdogan and having Sisi at the White House, in terms of both Erdogan and Duterte in the Philippines, that has a lot to do with Trump's businesses in both Istanbul and Manila. And again, Henry was basically saying, look, this guy's already vulnerable on money laundering and racketeering because the money that's gone into these projects comes from these kleptocrats. So do we have a foreign policy of sucking up to kleptocrats because Trump can't tell the difference between his own business enterprises and American foreign policy?
Well, I think that that's one very, very large concern and possibility that we have right now. I think first, it's very hard for us to, of course, know the details of what's going on because Trump has not released his tax returns, nor has he, of course, released other information that might give us a sense as to what kinds of exact financial interests and dealings he has in some of these places and how he might gain by engagement with these governments. The second issue here, I think, is, of course, that he did not divest and that whatever, you know, barriers he supposedly has put in place between him and the Trump organization and their business interests, that does nothing to get in the way of the benefits, financial and otherwise, that he will eventually gain, if not immediately, by promoting the Trump brand. And, of course, in all of these places, it's very difficult to tell exactly what he's doing because we're not privy to the conversations that he is having, nor are we privy to the conversations that the Trump organization is having with officials in these countries. And so it is impossible for us to tell. But if you just look at the bits of reporting and public information that's out there, it seems incredibly clear that the Trump administration is at the very least gaining significant benefits from its relations to these countries and having President Trump in the Oval Office. You know, you mentioned Duterte in the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, where, of course, the Trump Organization has interests in both of those countries. Another country that, frankly, is out there as well is Argentina. And Argentina is a friendly country to the United States. They are led by a leader, Mr. Macri, who is a friend of the United States. We have no apparent issues necessarily with Argentina and its government, unlike we do in these other places. And nevertheless, he talked to Mr. Macri during the transition period, and there were reports out of that conversation that Mr. Trump raised issues related to Trump Organization dealings in Argentina. And lo and behold, Mr. Macri got himself an invite to the White House in the first few months of Mr. Trump's presidency. So all the indications we have so far is that not only is he gaining, Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization, from being present financially through these dealings, but that he happens to be, whether coincidence or otherwise, making friends with the leaders of countries where the Trump Organization has interests.
Sure, and we've just seen Jared Kushner's sister in Beijing soliciting investments to the Kushner real estate empire, promising the Chinese investors green cards. So it's there's a trickle-down emoluments going on here.
Exactly.
I thank you for joining us. I'm sorry we've run out of time, Michael, but let's stay in touch.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Fuchs, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues, and also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, where he worked on cybersecurity and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into the hearings today in the context of what the U.S., France, and Germany can do to prevent further Russian interference in their elections. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Yuri Friedman, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers global affairs. He was previously the deputy managing editor at Foreign Policy, and his latest article at The Atlantic is France's Political Crisis Just Beginning? Welcome to Background Briefing, Yuri Friedman.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And France dodged a bullet. The EU sighed a great sigh of relief. Angela Merkel is obviously happy that the worst didn't happen in terms of the further unraveling of the EU following Brexit. But as you point out, this young new leader of France, Emmanuel Macron, doesn't really have a party. The two main parties, in many ways, like the two main parties over here. In our last election, Donald Trump is hardly a Republican, and one of the leading candidates on the Democratic side was a socialist. So let's start with that premise. How much have the main parties in France all but disappeared?
What's happened in this election cycle is really astounding. Never before in the history of the French Fifth Republic, which started in 1958, has the second round of the presidential election not featured a representative from either the main left-wing party or the main right-wing party. So it's a bit roughly different systems, but roughly like, you know, the Republicans and Democratic Party main candidates not making it past the primaries. You had a far-right nationalist candidate against someone who created their political movement last year. And so I think this really was, in a lot of ways, a rejection of the political establishment, no matter which candidate you chose. You know, a lot of mainstream politicians in France have been praising the fact that Macron won and congratulating him, but he is far from, you know, a entrenched member of the political establishment. He certainly served in government. He went to top schools. He was an investment banker. But in terms of his stature within the political establishment, he is kind of a newcomer, and that is a major rejection. I think it reflects something really critical about the mood of the French electorate right now, which is that there's a lot of disillusionment with politics. You know, 70% of French voters say they don't have confidence in government right now. I think you saw that in the results on Sunday.
But is there the ability to, I mean, is there a kind of a patronage system in France like there is in most countries? I mean, for example, Donald Trump is going to be in an unusual situation where he's got more federal judges he can appoint than just about any of his predecessors, and he's about to start doing that. And we know that he doesn't like a lot of the judges that have ruled against him so far. Mm-hmm. So that's just an example of a patronage system, if you will. But how powerful is the French civil service? In other words, if this guy doesn't have a political infrastructure, is there one that he can co-opt?
Yes, I think there is. There are ways that he can kind of build up a political infrastructure and political organization very quickly. So, for example, he has said he is going to have a candidate run under his banner, his political movement, in every one of France's electoral districts. And this is for the upcoming parliamentary elections in June. France always has a presidential election, and then a little while later they have a parliamentary election. And the idea traditionally has been, you know, you elect someone to the presidency, and then on their coattails, that party wins a majority in parliament, and they can kind of govern. They appoint a prime minister, and they can govern with undivided government. There's questions now about whether Macron can do that because his political movement is so new. But what you're probably going to see is some socialist and Republican politicians kind of run under his banner to kind of jump over to his side since he has all the political momentum. And even if he doesn't, the French voters are typically don't like undivided government. They want the government to function well and smoothly and efficiently. And so I think you will see a lot of people under this new, you know, on the move movement be elected into the legislature. And so he will be able to build an organization from the ground up and support in the legislature very quickly. And beyond that, I think there is an ability for him, once he has the levers of government, to, you know, to implement a number of his policies. Where I think he will find the most obstruction is in some of his most ambitious reform policies. For example, loosening French labor laws, because right now it's hard to hire, fire, and negotiate with workers. He also wants to cut government spending, implement tax cuts. These are things that are really have been tried by past leaders and not worked, and now he doesn't have the traditional party structure that other leaders have had. So I think he's going to run into a lot of difficulty there, but he might be able to do it.
Now, on the eve of the election, of course, there was this massive data dump from hacking, which has been attributed to Fancy Bear, a part of the Russian military intelligence, the GRU. Those are the people that hacked into the DNC and to John Podesta. So there are hearings today, of course, with Sally Yates and the former DNI General Clapper. Questions are being asked about France and in the context of what happened in America. The hearings are about Russia itself and where to go forward and to prevent Russia from doing what it has succeeded in doing in interfering in the American election and just having interfered in the French election. Is there likely to be a backlash, a blowback from this? I'm astounded that more Americans aren't annoyed or angry or indignant about Russians interfering or Putin interfering in our elections here, the Republicans, for reasons which seem fairly nakedly partisan, don't seem to think it's a big deal that they helped elect Trump. But I get the impression the French are a little more peeved.
Yeah, I think one thing that's been striking is how muted the response was in France. I think there are a few different reasons for this. One was the leaks happened on Friday, just before midnight. And in France, you know, after midnight on Friday, going into the election on Sunday, there's a media blackout. So the media can't really talk about the election. The candidates themselves can't talk about the election. On the one hand, you could say maybe these leaks of emails from the Macron campaign were timed specifically for that purpose, so that they would go right into the blackout and no one would be able to talk about them except on social media, where there would be like a, you know, a spin cycle of speculation. And so that could have been among the motivations of the leakers. On the other hand, what it did is it also muted the conversation in the mass media among the politicians. It wasn't like Marine Le Pen could, you know, find some juicy tidbit in the leaks and then publicize it on the campaign trail. And so I think that was one reason why the response was so muted. I think there was also something even more banal. There just wasn't so much that was very interesting in those leaks. From what we know so far, from anything that's been discussed, it's not like there was anything scandalous. And I think that also played a role in it not getting much attention. And I think beyond that, there has been some lessons learned from the U.S. campaign about the fact that discussing these leaks can be as powerful as the leaks themselves, in that it can change the course of these leaks don't work in terms of altering political outcomes unless they are discussed and dissected and widely disseminated. And that did not happen. I think those, you know, I'm sure there were many French voters and French media outlets and French politicians who said, we're not going to play this game again. And one thing to clarify is we really don't know yet who was behind these leaks. It wasn't WikiLeaks publicized it, but it wasn't published through WikiLeaks. It was done online through an anonymous posting site called Pastebin. There's some suspicions among some cybersecurity firms that the same Russian hackers were behind this, but we don't know for sure. Whatever the case, it is pretty clear that the goal was to interfere in the election. And so whether it was Russia or independent non-state actors, this is just happening more and more. The people think they can influence elections by hacking, and what France kind of showed, even more than the U.S. perhaps, because it was more experienced in these matters after the U.S. election, is how do we as free democratic societies respond to these leaks? What's the best way to do that? I think they provided a pretty strong example on Sunday.
But in the broader sense, surely Putin lost, even if there's not the indignation that I'm surprised isn't more intense over here. It's pretty shameful, I think, that the Republicans, who normally were not particularly friendly towards the Soviet Union during the Cold War, are suddenly making apologies for Putin. And even in some cases, like Dana Rohrabacher and others, basically, you know, supporting him along with Donald Trump, up until lately, shall we say. But prior to the elections, it was pretty clear. Le Pen was over there meeting with Putin. No question about her ties to him. Fillon was quite sympathetic, had business ties to some of Putin's cronies. Mélenchon, the far-left guy, he was a supporter of Putin's. So the only person in the running that wasn't close to Putin won. So is that a rebuke?
I think officials in the Kremlin, including Vladimir Putin, were not super happy with the result on Sunday. I think they would not have preferred Macron. He certainly was the least favorable candidate to them. And the suspicions of Russian involvement in this latest hack are only going to harden Macron's attitude towards Russia, whether or not it bears out that it was the Russian government that was behind this. I think Fillon or Le Pen would have been much more preferable candidates. Their policies aligned with what the Kremlin wants. But I think that, you know, the Russian government is going to have to work with Macron, and they kind of acknowledge that in their statement after the election, saying we want to dispel mutual distrust and work together on terrorism. Now, that's pretty rich, considering that they met with Le Pen during the election. Who knows how Macron's government is going to take that. But I think this was a blow to what they would have wanted to see in the region. I think the election of Donald Trump, to be honest, is also not necessarily working out according to the way they might have thought it would. You know, right after the election, there was a lot of euphoria in Moscow about the fact that this would be a new era in U.S.-Russian relations. And what we're seeing right now is that has stalled. There is not a lot of signs of real progress. You know, the Trump and Putin had a phone call the other day, and there was talk of a possible meeting. Maybe we'll meet, they'll meet, but there has not been a kind of renaissance of U.S.-Russian relations, a crusade to fight terrorism and get along great that people might have expected right after the election.
But in these hearings today, co-chaired by Lindsey Graham and Sheldon Whitehouse, a lot of what they're saying, and General Clapper reiterated this, is we're learning about what the Russians are up to in terms of manipulating our elections and the French elections and the Dutch elections and then the upcoming German elections. And the lessons learned are meant to prevent it, and we got to figure out ways to prevent it next time around. And Lindsey Graham hinted that we've got to get tough with the Russians, otherwise they'll keep doing it because they've been successful so far. Now, Angela Merkel met just a few days ago in Sochi with Putin, and they talked a lot about this interference as well, I understand. What is the problem that the Europeans have with getting tough with Russia? My understanding is it's because of Gazprom, their dependence on Russian gas, and is that the explanation, or are there things that the Russians can do, just as Lindsey Graham hinted today in the hearings, that America should do in terms of getting tough against the Russians screwing with their elections?
Yeah, I think you're totally right that energy supplies is a big reason why Europe has always been ambivalent about taking too tough a position with the Russians. On the other hand, they have some incentive to do it because Russia is, you know, their neighbor, and Russian actions in Ukraine, for example, have raised concerns that that kind of situation could happen in Baltic countries, which are part of NATO. I would say Europe is both more ambivalent because of their dependency on gas energy supplies, and also more urgently involved in this issue than America is, because America's, you know, separated by the Atlantic Ocean. Europe is dealing with this right on in their neighborhood. I think there are certain things that Europe and the United States can do. One that I found was very interesting is that there's been the head of the digital operations for Macron's campaign said that when they found out that there were all these cyber attacks against their campaign, they actually tried to send them all this false information. And they actually used cyber techniques to retaliate against the hackers, whoever they were. I think that's a really interesting model, which is that if we know these things are inevitable, whether or not they're being directed by a government or a non-government actor, how can we create better cyber defenses and actually fool these folks? If we know it's going to happen, how can campaigns and political operations get more savvy? Beyond that, I think there is a real question right now about what is proper retaliation for these kinds of interference in our democratic processes. So what you saw with the Obama administration is a real belated response. And then when they did respond, they kicked out some diplomats, they imposed sanctions. And I think there is a question of whether that really had a deterrent effect. Would something more swift have made a bigger difference? Would taking means that were, more aggressive have made a difference? And I think we have not seen that in the case of France, because there's really the attribution isn't there. The attribution that we had in the U.S. election by the intelligence agencies was much more conclusive than what we've seen so far from the French election. But I think there is an open debate right now that about what is the proper response. And I think what governments like Russia or non-state actors are exploiting right now is that these societies don't have great responses. And so they know that these societies are vulnerable to this kind of interference because people don't know exactly how to respond. So I think that is one of the big tasks ahead. If the U.S. election and the French election and all these European elections have proven anything, it's that these societies and the people in these societies need to have a debate and come up with some, you know, actual concrete plans for when this occurs, because it's going to occur. It's only going to occur more. How do societies respond, and how do they deter it from happening? And I think we don't have concrete answers there yet.
Well, when you talk about Obama's response to the hacking, that's key to the hearings today, of course, because Sally Yates was talking about General Flynn and what they knew about him and from the intercepts with his meetings with the Russians, and they happened on the very eve of Obama taking action, and Obama's people were worried that Flynn would leak it to the Russians, which is what he did. And we don't know whether or not Flynn leaked the really important stuff, which is who was going to be sanctioned, and therefore, you know, these guys could move their money electronically before they were frozen by Treasury. So we'll, I guess, eventually find out about that. But in terms of leverage, because of Western Europe's dependence upon Russian gas through Gazprom, I believe the Dutch have built some LNG terminals and they get liquefied natural gas from Qatar. But the Qataris want to build a pipeline across Syria into the Mediterranean. But many people think that that's exactly why Putin's intervened in Syria, to prevent that from happening, because he doesn't want any alternatives to Western Europe dependent upon his gas. What do you know about alternative supplies that the Europeans might be looking at in order to be less dependent on the Russians?
Yeah, I think you know, I can't say a ton about what specific alternatives they are looking at, but I think that because there haven't been many credible proposals put on the table. But I was talking to Senator Chris Murphy, who is a Democrat, and he had an interesting point in relation to this, which was his whole argument. He's trying to put forward a Democratic vision of what foreign policy could look like, you know, as an alternative to Trump's vision right now. And he, one of his big arguments is that we need to de-emphasize the military relative to other economic and diplomatic levers that we have at our disposal. And one of his arguments was that there's so much talk about, you know, building up NATO as a deterrence to Russian aggression and doing various sorts of military buildups to deter America's enemies more broadly. And he was saying, why doesn't the U.S. invest more economically in helping Europe identify credible alternatives to Russian oil and Russian energy supplies? Because that would, you know, advance the goal of making Russia have less leverage with these countries than it does now. And part of his point is we don't really know the answers of what the best alternatives are, but we need to invest more in this if we really are serious about deterring Russian aggression, whether it's military aggression or cyber aggression. So I think that is something that could be done. But the U.S. government isn't currently working with Europe very much to do it. And more broadly than that, than just energy supplies, European governments, you see, are taking more safeguards in general to deter interference in their elections. So, for example, the Dutch election, which happened pretty recently, they actually counted all ballots by hand in order to try to protect themselves against any kind of cyber meddling. So we're seeing governments take more preventative measures as well, knowing that this is a reality of 21st century democracy.
Well, Yuri Friedman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Yuri Friedman, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers global affairs. He was previously the deputy managing editor at Foreign Policy. And his latest article at The Atlantic is France's political crisis just beginning? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the firing of five scientists on the EPA's Board of Scientific Counselors, with the likely purge of up to a dozen on the 18-member board. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. And his latest book is The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thank you.
Well, you're going to have to write a sequel to your latest book, Michael, because the government of the United States is now being run by climate deniers in terms of the environment. The head of the EPA is a climate denier, and now he's purging the Environmental Protection Agency's Board of Scientific Counselors, which reviews the EPA's own research in an effort to sustain and enhance the quality of its science. And there are 18 members of this board. He's apparently firing five of them already, and he'll fire up to a dozen and put pro-industry people on, and they may not even have any scientific background. So what's happening here to the country? We're becoming brain dead, aren't we?
Back in September, how prescient it would be, because, of course, we are now very much in the madhouse of climate change denialism, where we've got a climate change denying president and a Congress that is run by climate change deniers, Republican climate change deniers. And as you note, Trump has appointed to key positions within his cabinet an array of climate change deniers and industry lobbyists. It is the veritable fox guarding the hen house when it comes to the way the administration is treating matters of science and science policy. And here we have the EPA. As you note, the EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, is a climate change denier. When he was Attorney General of Oklahoma, he ghostwrote policy documents that were ostensibly government documents, but they had been ghostwritten by fossil fuel interest. It's really remarkable. And this latest act now of getting rid of those members of this advisory board that are actually qualified, that have a background in the science, that's why these advisory boards exist. They have no actual administrative power. They can't make policy. They can't dictate policy. Their only role is to advise the administrator, so that the administrator, his decisions are informed by actual science. And what they're doing here is to get rid of those folks, many of them from academia, who are leading researchers in this area, and replacing them with the very fossil fuel interests and other polluting interests that the EPA was designed to regulate and to prevent them from doing damage to our environment. So it's, you know, in the end, it doesn't actually have any impact, because they have nothing other than an advisory role to the EPA administrator. But what's more important is what it communicates to all of us, that there is a total disdain by this administration, by this EPA administrator, for the environment, the very thing that the EPA was founded by, I would mention, you know, add a Republican president, Richard Nixon, to guard against.
Well, there's an Orwellian or Stalinist kind of quality to all this, and it goes to this alternative universe that Donald Trump and Stephen Bannon have created. And as we know, Donald Trump simply cannot tell the truth, and he doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. He doesn't even know when he's lying. He's just a sort of salesman who believes his pitch, and it's all situational ethics and whatever's happening at the moment. He changes it. He's all over the place because there's no moral core to this man. There's no moral compass here. But what he's done, and I think mostly it's the work of Bannon and others, they have an alternative universe of 86% of his people believe that Trump is trustworthy and honest and will fulfill his promises, and 78% of his followers believe that the mainstream media prints fake news. So Trump has created a situation where he's able to propagate fake news, which is believed by his followers, at the same time attacking the real news from, for example, the failing New York Times, etc. So that's right. The world we're in. How much is this crazy Orwellian Stalinist new think, I don't know what you call it, this alternative universe about how the environment is actually being protected by the Environmental Protection Agency, even though they're all working with the Koch brothers and others to liberate the fossil fuels people so they can pollute us into non-existence?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Stalinist, you know, moniker is appropriate here, because under Stalin, we had the era of Lysenko. Lysenko was this Soviet, basically a crackpot scientist who advocated crackpot theories about that basically went against our understanding of evolution. He argued that living things could acquire characteristics during their lifetime and pass them along, which, you know, is like a Lamarckian sort of point of view of the way biology works, which is completely wrong. But more than that, because he was the darling of Stalin, he essentially was able to control Soviet agricultural policy. Scientists who disagreed with him were put in jail. Some of them died in jail. And the official policy of the Soviet Union became this theory, this Lysenkoism, which it turns out when it was implemented led to massive blights, the massive famines, because it just didn't work. And so, you know, people died because the government decided for political reasons to adopt an anti-scientific policy. And, you know, the analogy is apt here, because what we're talking about is the denial by Republican congressmen and our administration and those he's appointed to the EPA and other key positions, the denial that there is even a problem when it comes to this existential problem, climate change, which is perhaps the greatest threat that we face. Even our national security leaders say that climate change is probably the greatest national security threat, because it is a it's what we call a threat multiplier. It takes existing tensions for food and water and land and makes them worse. And we're seeing that play out in Syria and in the Middle East and now in Europe in the form of ISIS. So this is literally a decision to make anti-science the official position of the administration in a way that threatens us all, in a very real way.
But in the context of fear, it is amazing to see, again, in going back to this alternative universe and this Orwellian Stalinism that Trump and Bannon are practicing and to some extent succeeding in, they are also, you know, as you know, they're cutting the budget of the EPA radically along with the State Department. And at the same time, they're increasing defense spending. So what, in effect, they're doing is they're telling us to be more and more afraid of the terrorists and less afraid of the real fear, which we should have, which is climate change. So they're ginning up an artificial fear about something that has a remote chance of happening. You have much greater chance of being struck by lightning than being killed by a terrorist. But we're all going to be affected by climate change, and we're going to be affected by it even in more impactful and horrendous terms because of the denial that's going on. Denial leads to delay, and that's the tragedy. We're starting to make some progress. We're starting to recognize the clear and present danger that threatens the planet and threatens our future and threatens our grandchildren. And yet these disgusting clowns are, what are they doing and why are they doing it? That's the key question.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Russian connection is an interesting one to talk about, because we know that the largest currently unexploited oil reserves in the world are in the Arctic coast of Russia. And it is no secret that ExxonMobil and Russia have wanted to collaborate in the extraction of these huge petroleum reserves for years, but they were barred from doing so because of sanctions that were placed during the Obama administration because of Russia's aggression elsewhere. And that it's pretty clear now what's happened since then. Well, the Trump administration clearly has very close ties to Russia. That's playing out right now in Senate hearings. Sally Yates is speaking to this very issue. And those ties seem to be related to a mutual interest on the part of those who surround Trump. He's appointed Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, to be his Secretary of State. It's impossible to ignore those connections. Ultimately, it looks like this is about exploiting this largest remaining fossil fuel reserve. And you can understand much of Trump's policies. You can understand the appointments he's made, and you can understand this Russian, this Russiagate scandal that he has become mired in through that lens, through understanding that this is ultimately about billions of dollars that of profits by fossil fuel interests and the cronies that they work with and affiliates of Donald Trump. If the Russians are able to mine that remaining oil reserve.
Well, of course, the sick irony here is that global warming is making it more possible to exploit the Arctic oil because of the planet warming and therefore
the loss of sea ice. Absolutely, the sea ice making it much easier to test. Yep.
But to put it in the broader context, isn't this the last hurrah of big oil? Even the Saudis have figured out it's not going to last much longer. You have companies like Tesla now having more market capitalization than General Motors. They make electric cars. We know that the future is to get off fossil fuels.
That's right.
But are these guys, they see the writing on the wall, and they just want to get every last drop of dinosaur blood out there to make money off. Is that what's happening?
That's exactly right. They still have these assets, these huge assets in the form of known fossil fuel reserves, and they want to exploit those assets. They don't want those assets to become stranded, which they will if we act on this problem as we need to. And so they recognize the writing is on the wall. The world is moving on. It's clear that we've moved on from the age of fossil fuels to the age of renewable energy. The rest of the world recognizes that. The countries who are leading, like China, are the ones who are benefiting in this economic race. And the irony is that by this retrenchment by the Trump administration and his affiliates back towards the continued exploitation of fossil fuels and the de-investment in the energy of the future, renewable energy, that is costing us our competitiveness in the global economy. We risk not being on board this train forward, which is, you know, the clean energy revolution. We risk getting left behind in the greatest economic revolution of this century because of the narrow fossil fuel interests and the profit motives of them and their cronies and Donald Trump. We risk falling behind the rest of the world, and it does mean it will be a little bit more difficult to stabilize warming below dangerous levels if Trump does indeed withdraw from the Paris summit, if he's successful in undoing the achievements of the Obama administration, the clean power plan and incentives for renewable energy that took place under the Obama administration. If he's successful in implementing that agenda, it is going to make it a little bit more difficult for the rest of the world to work toward keeping warming below catastrophic levels. So it's bad in every way imaginable. It's bad for us. It's bad for the planet. It's bad for the world. And it's bad economics as far as the U.S. is concerned.
So at what point do we get real with Trump and the Koch brothers and all of these lackeys that he's got in his cabinet and Tillerson, obviously, he's already made the deal with Putin. It's just a question of getting rid of the sanctions and going for the oil. And you know that Putin uses Gazprom as leverage over Western Europe, as mad as they are about his interference in the French elections and the upcoming German elections. At the same time, they're all hooked on Russian gas. And that's the game that he plays, and that's why he's in Syria. He's in Syria to stop the Qataris from building a pipeline into the Mediterranean so that they can compete with Gazprom, which he doesn't want. So he plays this game very, very effectively.
Well, and it's all about fossil fuels. And once again, as you know, even the reason for the sanctions that are preventing them from exploiting the Arctic oil is their fossil fuel policies in the first place. Their overly aggressive fossil fuel policies. Yeah.
So, can we start a global movement since the planet's endangered, and we're all in this lifeboat Earth together? And the people that are running this country are engaged in a criminal activity. It's known as reckless endangerment. It's against the law.
Yeah.
Can we make this case that these people are criminals because they are deliberately suppressing the reality of what's happened to the planet and making it much more likely that effects of climate change will be far more catastrophic than they would otherwise be because we're delaying dealing with this problem?
Well, you know, it's much like Al Capone. It may be the smaller infractions that get them rather than the larger infractions, which are hidden in plain view, which you allude to. So, you know, we may indeed see, based on what happens with the FBI investigation and Russiagate, we may well see, you know, Trump impeached. But even then, you still have several layers down of Republican leadership that are still very much part of the sort of Koch brothers' agenda of fossil fuel, continued sort of fossil fuel intensive economy. I think at this point, only the will of the people can change this. The midterm elections, if we are to see a shakeup in Congress, that would make it more difficult for Trump to implement his fossil fuel agenda, his agenda of incentivizing fossil fuels and de-incentivizing renewable energy. And at the same time, we are seeing efforts at the state level, at the municipal level, to move in the direction that we know we need to move in. And we're actually seeing progress there, even while, we lack leadership at the top level when it comes to energy and climate policy. We do have enlightened governments at the state level, at the city level, and we're making enough progress there that as long as that progress continues and the rest of the world moves in the direction that it's clearly moving, away from fossil fuels toward renewable energy, then I feel that we can recover from this temporary setback. That's the way I look at it. It's a temporary setback. Obviously, if this were to remain our policy, if Trump and congressional Republicans were able to hold power for, 4 years, 8 years, then there's a lot more damage that could be done. The amount of damage that can be done in one term, I think, is somewhat limited. If you do the math, Trump alone cannot put a big enough dent in the the cuts that we're seeing in fossil fuel reliance on fossil fuels. He can't make a big enough dent in that progress to change our course that much. If those policies were to remain in place for 8 years or more, we are the second largest emitter. China's the largest emitter on the planet, but we're the second largest emitter. We're responsible for, somewhere close to 10% more of global carbon emissions. Progress can still be made even without the U.S. taking a leadership role, as long as that lack of leadership doesn't persist.
Well, Michael Mann, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, the director of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.